Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Archery's podcast. Today I will summarize and review the book. The Big Con Crackpot Economics and the Fleecing of America is a political journalism and policy critique by Jonathan Chait that examines how a small but influential network of conservative economic ideologues helped reshape American politics over several decades. Published in the mid-2000s. The book focuses on supply-side economics and the broader conservative project that promoted tax cuts, market fundamentalism, and anti-government rhetoric as common sense, despite weak evidence and repeated policy failures. Chait presents the book as an investigation into how these ideas entered mainstream debate, were normalized by political elites, and became durable even when they lacked broad public support. Rather than treating the story as a technical economics text, he frames it as a political history of persuasion, manipulation, and institutional capture. The result is a work aimed at readers who want to understand how economic arguments are used in partisan conflict and how policy can be driven by ideology more than evidence. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, how supply-side economics became a political weapon. A central focus of the book is the rise of supply-side economics as an idea that was treated as serious policy, even though Chait presents it as intellectually weak and politically deceptive. He argues that the theory did not simply win because it was proven correct in practice. Instead, it spread because it offered conservatives a persuasive story about tax cuts, growth, and moral virtue that could be sold to politicians, donors, and media figures. The book emphasizes the distance between the theory's promises and the outcomes of the policies built from it. By tracing this gap, Chait shows that the appeal of supply-side economics was less about economic rigor than about its usefulness as a partisan instrument. This matters because it explains how bad policy can survive if an idea serves political goals. It can be insulated from normal standards of evaluation, even when experts, evidence, and public opinion point in the opposite direction. Secondly, the conservative activist network behind policy capture. The book does not present conservative economic dominance as a spontaneous ideological shift. Instead, it describes a network of activists, strategists, and media personalities who worked consistently to move the Republican Party and then the wider political system in their direction. Figures associated with the movement, including people such as Grover Norquist, Jack Abramoff, Karl Rove, and Ann Coulter, appear as examples of how ideology, fundraising, message discipline, and insider access reinforced one another. Chait's point is that policy capture often depends on organized minorities that understand institutions better than the broader public does. They can pressure elected officials, narrow the range of acceptable debate, and make certain positions appear inevitable. This topic is important because it shifts attention away from abstract party labels and toward the mechanisms of influence lobbying, repetition, media amplification, and strategic use of controversy. In that sense, the book is also about how political systems can be gamed by disciplined interest groups. Thirdly, why unpopular ideas can still govern the country. One of Chait's most striking arguments is that political success does not always track public approval. He repeatedly shows how conservative economic policies could remain influential even when they lacked wide support or produced disappointing results. The reason is not simply that voters were uninformed. The book suggests that institutional design, partisan loyalty, and elite messaging can allow a policy agenda to outlast the popularity of its underlying ideas. A party can lose elections or fail on specific issues and still shape the terms of debate by controlling donor networks, think tanks, and media narratives. This helps explain why repeated setbacks do not necessarily produce correction. Instead, bad ideas can become embedded in routine governance and policy assumptions. Chait uses this insight to challenge the comforting belief that democratic competition automatically filters out harmful economic doctrines. His analysis shows that when a movement gains a long-term grip on institutions, it can continue to set policy even while broad public sentiment points elsewhere. Fourthly, politics, media, and the normalization of economic extremism. The book argues that media and political elites played a major role in turning fringe economic ideas into respectable talking points. Chait is especially interested in how reporting conventions, balance-seeking journalism, and insider culture can lend legitimacy to positions that lack strong empirical support. When a controversial idea is repeated often enough by elected officials, commentators, and policy advocates, it can begin to sound like one side of a normal debate rather than a radical departure. This normalization is one of the book's key concerns because it shows how public language can be manipulated without overt coercion. The issue is not only that some politicians lie or exaggerate, but that institutions designed to inform the public may help obscure the difference between evidence-based policy and ideological marketing. By focusing on this process, Chait offers a critique of the broader information environment in Washington. He suggests that economic extremism becomes more durable when it is translated into familiar political language and treated as a legitimate viewpoint instead of a contested agenda. Lastly, satire, journalism, and the case for evidence-based policy. Although the book is sharply critical, it is written with wit and a polemical edge that helps it function as both journalism and argument. Chait uses satire not just for style, but as a method of exposing the gap between self-serving rhetoric and policy reality. That tone makes the book more readable. But it also serves a strategic purpose. Ridicule can be an effective way to show how implausible certain economic claims are once they are stripped of prestige. At the same time, the book remains grounded in an effort to explain policy history rather than merely mock opponents. This combination gives the work its distinctive character. It is not a neutral textbook, but it is also not a simplistic attack piece. Instead, it insists that economic policy should be judged by evidence, institutional consequences, and real-world outcomes. The broader implication is that public debate becomes healthier when it resists ideological branding and asks whether a policy actually works for the country as a whole. In conclusion, The Big Con is best suited for readers who want to understand the intersection of economics, ideology, and political power in modern American government. It will be especially useful to students of politics, journalists, policy readers, and general audiences trying to make sense of why certain economic ideas persist even after they have been widely challenged. Its practical value lies in helping readers recognize how policy narratives are built, how elites can launder weak ideas into mainstream respectability, and why public opinion alone does not always determine outcomes. Intellectually, the book stands out because it is not a technical economics defense or a simple partisan complaint. It is a piece of political explanation that connects ideas to institutions, media, and strategy. Compared with more neutral policy histories, it is sharper, more opinionated, and more focused on the mechanisms of manipulation. That makes it especially memorable for readers who want a clear account of how supply-side economics moved from the margins into the center of American politics, and why that shift mattered far beyond tax policy. If you would like to support Jonathan Chait, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.